KQED.
And welcome back to Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, here today for Michael Krasny. Well, U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions issued a memo last week instructing federal prosecutors to seek the maximum sentences possible. The order reverses Obama-era guidelines that limited penalties for low-level and nonviolent offenders. And the federal policy change comes as California begins implementation of Proposition 57. That measure, passed last fall, allows early release of those in prison for some nonviolent felonies. We're going to look at how both policy changes could affect California. Joining us in the studio is Catherine Hahn. She's a federal prosecutor with the U.S. Department of Justice in San Francisco. And Alex Bosansky, president of Impact Justice. That's a national innovation and research center that investigates criminal justice issues. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Let me begin, and I'll put this one to you, Catherine. Explain this memo. How significant is it, do you think, in terms of a change of direction for
Sure.
the department?
Well, I really don't think. I've been hearing it's being called a watershed event, and it changes everything. It requires us to seek statutory maximum penalties in every case. And that's actually not the case. The statutory maximum penalties are typically, in a lot of cases involving drugs, life. So it does not direct us to seek the statutory maximum penalties. But I think apart from that, what we've really gone back to is the first term of the Obama administration and every administration that preceded him, whether Clinton or Bush. So this is really a more minimal change than I think it's being cast as.
And what prompted it?
Well, I mean, one of the things that prompted it is prosecutors' hands under the preceding memo, which was the last 4 years of the Obama administration, not the first term. That memo really tied the hands of prosecutors from having any kind of leverage to get to the next level up in certain kinds of drug cases.
And what was happening as a result from their perspective?
From the perspective of prosecutors?
Yeah.
I mean, one of the things that the Holder memo said is that we can't use all of the tools in our arsenal, basically, which are leverage of mandatory minimums and of filing priors. We can't use those tools unless a certain checklist of items were also available, were also readily provable at the time of charging. The defendant was engaged in gangs, had close ties to cartels, had firearms.
So I hear you saying that this has been sort of mischaracterized by the media, essentially. Is that what you're saying?
I think it has been, yes.
Yeah. Alex Bosansky, what would you add to that? Would you agree with her characterization of it? And, you know, how do you see it, either the same or differently?
This is a significant departure from what had begun under the Obama administration and what Eric Holder had put in place as attorney general. And it's significant because it says that we're going to go back to a way of prosecuting and investigating cases that just doesn't work. And it doesn't work because the impact on communities of color, particularly black and brown people, is tremendous. And we have seen across the political spectrum in this country on a state and local level and on a federal level, Republicans and Democrats, saying that mandatory minimums don't work, that forcing people to plead to the highest possible charge with the longest possible sentence doesn't work. And I was a former prosecutor.
When you say it doesn't work, what, like, doesn't work in what
way? It doesn't work in that it doesn't give us the public safety that we want, and it doesn't give us on an individual level the outcomes for the people's lives that we're impacting, right? Prosecution hurts people. Right? It takes them out of their community. It takes them away from their family. It takes them away from their children. And if you look across this country, you can see the decimation that the last 25 years of police, prosecution, judge, probation department, criminal justice behavior has impacted the lives of people.
But you're not saying seeking the maximum is inappropriate in all situations.
I think it is inappropriate. Right. The argument is that this is a tool that prosecutors need to be able to get to other cases, right? That we need the leverage of mandatory minimums. We need the leverage of high sentences to be able to force people, to compel them to behave in a way we want in our investigation. I don't believe that's what our justice system is about. Justice is supposed to be hard, right? It's supposed to be difficult. It's not supposed to be easy. And it's supposed to be fair to the individual.
Catherine Hahn, this is a bit of a digression from what we were talking about, but the Department of Justice has undergone a huge upheaval in terms of policy from Eric Holder and Loretta Lynch to now Jeff Sessions. There's all kinds of turmoil at the FBI. You know, we've been talking about it for days now. How is that affecting prosecutors in the Department of Justice?
Well, I think when you're talking about line-level prosecutors, which is what I was up until yesterday for over a decade, I think when you're talking
about— What happened yesterday?
Yesterday was my last day. I was asked to do this show before that, but yesterday was my last day after 11 years as a federal prosecutor.
Did you voluntarily left?
Yes, I did. But I would just say that, you know, look, I agree with everything Alex just said about we're seeking justice. I mean, that's certainly why I was doing my job, and that's why my colleagues that I had were doing their jobs. And I think that mission has not been interrupted. It's continued, and it's continued strongly today because we're talking about line-level prosecutors in 94 different offices across the country that keep on running, that keep doing the work that needs to be done. But I do think, you know, just to Alex's point, I mean, I agree. There is no one size fits all. If there's anything I've learned in being a prosecutor all these years, it's that just like humans, every case is different.
Do you think, you know, obviously the Obama administration, Eric Holder, the former attorney general, had a perspective on sort of what Alex was describing, that this sort of tough on crime approach was not good at the community level. It resulted in mass incarcerations that were inappropriate in many cases. Do prosecutors are they, you know, supportive of that notion at all?
I think I can only speak to my own experience and the experiences that I saw. But I think the trend that has widespread support, of course, even amongst the prosecutorial and law enforcement community, is not to fill up the prisons with low-level drug offenders. No one wants that. No one thinks that's the best use of resources. However, I think that has been wildly mischaracterized in the narrative that we have going on right now, that the prisons are just simply full of nonviolent offenders. And let me tell you why. I had a number of cases where there was a lot of violence, shooting at police, going out of a window, Nuestra Familia prison gang, people down the street from the studio here with machine guns. But they all also happened to be dealing whether methamphetamine or crack cocaine or other drugs, heroin. What ends up happening is when you're doing a plea bargain as a prosecutor, sometimes the defense lawyers will say, oh, do you have to charge the attempted murder too? Can't we call it a day? Can't we just call it a day and give him 10 years and charge him with the drug crime? So in the interests of efficiency and moving cases through the system so we can move on to the next violent person, we would strike that deal. And so what you end up with is the offense of conviction might be drug trafficking or drug crimes, but that's not capturing the full conduct of what that individual did.
So it's understating it.
It's absolutely understating it. And these offenses of conviction are not the only things that you can look to because, of course, this one particular case I just gave you where the guy was shooting at the police going out the window, his sentence was one of the ones that was later reduced saying he was a nonviolent drug offender. Well, he was the exact opposite of nonviolent. He was a career offender who, you know, had a long history of firearms and had used them.
And so this change of policy would affect that how?
Well, in one way, again, when I prosecuted him, I had the ability to seek that mandatory minimum, which was 10 years in that case, which was, I think everyone would agree. I mean, the defendant agreed, the defense lawyer agreed, that was a fair and appropriate penalty for what his conduct was, which was not just drug dealing. And I think that's another point that we need to make. The vast majority, the overwhelming majority of federal narcotics cases are not low-level drug dealers. I think there's this real misperception that, oh, this is about street-level hand-to-hand crack deals. This is about people shipping marijuana. This is not about that. This is about people dealing 5 keys of heroin or fentanyl, bringing those into the country. You know, that's 50,000 doses of heroin.
Alex Wisniewski, what would you add to that narrative?
I would say that we all want our communities to be safe. The question is, how do we make them safe? Mandatory minimums drive excessive sentences for people. There's a false debate about is it a violent, nonviolent offense? What was the impact on the community, not on the community? The question is this the effective way for us to reduce crime, to make communities safer, and to help individuals? And we are warehousing people, literally, over and over again.
Well, what about her point that it's sort of a hammer that prosecutors can use and that when we look at, you know, the ultimate conviction, it may not reflect what they did. It was part of a deal to, you know, get it cleaned up and, you know, send the person to prison.
It's certainly a hammer, and the question is how big of a hammer do you need to deal with the problem? But more importantly, that hammer is, in a sense, abused, right? And it's abused in this way, which is it incentivizes local police to bring certain kinds of cases, particularly drug cases, to the federal system and not to the local system because of the harsh mandatory minimums and because of the sentencing guidelines. It also allows prosecutors to really hold out high, high sentences right? Sometimes life. And the only trade-off the defendant can make is to plead guilty and to cooperate. And that cooperation and that plea, I think, is coercive on some level. It's coercive in the justice system on a set of values, and it's coercive to an individual who might not have anything to offer but has to start naming names to be able to get out from under it.
Catherine Hahn, I'm sure most prosecutors wouldn't abuse the discretion or the power that they have, but some probably do. Is it appropriate to basically, as the Attorney General has done, require that all prosecutors in all these cases seek the maximum instead of giving them flexibility?
Well, again, it doesn't require them to seek the maximum, because when you're talking about statutory maximums, that's different from mandatory minimums. So I want to be clear on that. But look, what this memo does is give individual discretion back to the prosecutors. Those of us who are on the front lines, who are interacting with the defendants and with the defendant's lawyers, who know the circumstances, who get a pre-sentence report that the court's officers prepare detailing that defendant's particular circumstances, upbringing, prior convictions. And I've got to tell you that by the time these kind of cases are being brought by agents or police to the federal system, we are talking about career offenders. We're talking about gang members. We're talking about people who have machine guns or firearms with them that they've brandished. And let me tell you why. I'm making up these numbers just for the sake of simplicity. But let's say we have 1,000 crimes out there. Let's say the FBI agents that I work with, they don't have the resources to investigate and bring 1,000 cases to me. So they're going to pick the best 100.
The best and meaning what?
The best, and I'll get to that. They'll pick the best cases, the most righteous. That's what it means.
Okay.
The most righteous cases, the ones that most people would agree, these are the cases that should be brought federally. But you know what? I can't take all 100 cases. Let's say I only have room on my docket for 10 of those cases. I'm going to select then the 10 best of those 100 that have been selected from the 1,000 to bring federally, because I want to get the most bang for my buck. Where is it going to make the most difference to a community? Who are we taking off the streets? Are we taking off a violent, violent career repeat offender, or are we going after a low-level dealer? The choice is clear to me if you have to pick between those two, who I'm going to spend my resources going after.
We're talking with Alex Busansky from Impact Justice and Catherine Hahn, former federal prosecutor with the with the Department of Justice here in San Francisco, talking about a change of direction from the U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions in terms of penalties. If you'd like to join us, you can reach us at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. You can also email us at forum@kqed.org, leave a message on our Facebook page, or tweet us. We're at KQED Forum. Let me ask you this, Catherine Hahn. What do these federal policy changes mean for state cases, and how many, drug cases come under the federal system?
Well, historically and still, this has not changed at all, that you can have drug cases brought statewide. You can also have them brought federally. And what it typically comes down to is the federal cases. We're going to reserve the federal cases for the most serious offenders, as I just said, where we can make the most impact. And so I think there's really no change that this memo affects in terms of that. I did want to Alex mentioned cooperation, and should we use this as leverage for cooperation? And I think one thing is it's easy to cast that as, oh, it's a threat, plead or else. But I think what needs to also be told as part of this discourse, or the point that needs to be made, is that cooperation is critical to our ability to getting up to the next level in the food chain of the more serious criminals, the more heavy-hitting drug kingpins.
Cooperation between prosecutors
and lower-level kind of dealers. And I don't mean street dealers. I still mean serious, violent dealers, but that are not necessarily at the top of the food chain. They're not the drug kingpin. And what we need is we need to get up to that level. We need the cooperation of people who are working for those individuals. And essential to getting that cooperation is having that leverage in your back pocket that you can have a mandatory minimum. You can file a prior. And I would say that the cooperation that it's critical to getting is what those are the kind of cases the public wants us to bring, the drug kingpin cases, the ones that are wreaking the most havoc on communities, not the lower level dealers.
Alex Busansky, let me ask you, California, of course, and other states, but California in particular has gone in a very different direction. Both the voters have passed things reforming the three strikes law. They've reformed sentencing for low level nonviolent offenders. They've made it easier through Prop 57 for those folks to get out of jail on a prison on parole more easily, perhaps. We'll wait and see how that's implemented. It's probably too soon. We don't really have a ton of data. It's too soon to say how well that's working. But what impact do you see this shift in priorities at the federal level having, if any, on what California is trying to do?
Well, California is not alone. What California is doing is happening around the country. Rick Perry, when he was governor of Texas, made significant reforms in how they prosecuted drug offenses. Mike Pence, when he was governor of Indiana, did the same. What we're going to see is, I think, U.S. Attorney's Office, a federal prosecutor's office, that's going in the wrong direction, and it's going in the opposite direction. I think you're going to see form shopping by police officers bringing cases to the feds.
And
I
think just explain what form shopping is.
So if you're a police
officer,
has nothing
to do with our program.
No, not at all. As Catherine said, right, a police officer, a crime can be prosecuted either federally or by the state. For many people in law enforcement, if they see a higher penalty on the federal level, they'll bring their case as a police officer, right, as a law enforcement officer, to the feds. And I take issue with this idea that somehow the best cases, the cream of the crop of cases, the most significant ones are the ones that feds nationally are prosecuting. If you look at the growth of the federal prison population, it's been through the roof, right, outstripping all other type of offenses.
And even in the last 5 or 6 years under Obama?
There's been a slight drop since Eric Holder and Obama changed federal policy. But the trend to that point was going up, and that trend is going to go going up again, and we're spending billions of dollars. Look, if you call a plumber, they're going to tell you you have a plumbing problem, right? The question is that really what you should be spending your money on? Or do you need to step back and take a holistic approach and a look at what's going on in your community? And prosecution is not the key.
And Catherine, the U.S. is out of step with most countries in the world, right? Most Western democracies. I mean, there are very few countries that incarcerate as many people per capita as the U.S., very few.
That's true. There's also very few countries who have as high of violent crime rates in their inner cities in the Western, as you said, the Western Hemisphere, I think you just said, or Western Europe. We have a lot more serious violent crimes involving firearms. And, you know, that really is something that we can't overlook, the use of firearms in these crimes. And I will tell you one thing. I was thinking about it in preparation for this show. In absolutely every drug case that I have ever brought as a prosecutor, and I've done all kinds. I've done murder cases, bank robberies, cybercrime, white collar, bank fraudsters, and plenty of drug defendants. And in every single case of a drug crime I ever brought, there were firearms, and I mean plural firearms, and they were repeat offenders. Because one of the things that also isn't getting mentioned as part of this discourse is there's something called the safety valve. Are you familiar with the safety valve? The safety valve says if you are a first-time offender, it's a statutory protection built in to save defendants. To save the cases Alex is talking about of, across the country, this could be happening in other jurisdictions. The safety valve says if you're a low-level drug offender and you don't have firearms and this is your first offense, you're not subject to that mandatory minimum.
All right. I want to try to bring some of our listeners in. Let's go to Palo Alto. And Andy, welcome.
Yeah, hi. Thanks. I'd like to challenge Catherine on the assumption that a lot of the drug offenses actually have violence hidden behind them, and they may not even look that way when you're looking how to release nonviolent offenders. I mean, I think that there very likely are lots of nonviolent offenders who are incarcerated for undue amounts of time, and one such person is a good friend of mine who actually was growing medicinal marijuana in California, and then the feds actually took him to a minimum 10-year sentence because he was allegedly growing near a school, but what his intention was to actually sell and distribute to medicinal dispensaries in San Jose. And during the court case, he wasn't even allowed to enter that as a defense because the federal government doesn't recognize the medicinal value. So the guy got put in there for 10 years, spent 7 years, lost a lot of time with his family, totally nonviolent. And that's just one example that I'm personally familiar with. But I kind of question your assumption that these, quote, nonviolent offenders who are sitting there for drug offenses actually have violent histories that just don't show up.
Right.
That doesn't smell right to me.
Yeah. All right. Catherine?
Well, I think I'm speaking from personal experience, Andy, and I know that it's, again, not one size fits all. Of course, there are examples that you can point to probably across the country of someone who knows someone who doesn't fit what I just said. But I'm telling you, in my experience in over a decade of doing this, that it is the overwhelming majority of people that are subject to mandatory minimums. That's what we're talking about, not just drug offenses that are in prison, but mandatory minimums, which is what we're talking about today, are violent And there is what I call a plus factor, or what Eric Holder called a plus factor, aggravating factors. They're gang members. Again, firearms are a big kind of trigger for us, cartel connections, etc. In the case of your friend, I did hear that you mentioned he served 10 years, but then served 7 years. So I'm wondering if he was subject to the safety valve. But I think really, given the circumstances you just described, I think the fact that he was growing near a school is what was driving that. Because, of course, Congress has enhanced the penalties for people who engage in drug crimes near schools.
Quick comment, Alex.
We keep focusing on the problem and not on the solution. And the solution is not longer sentences, it's not harsher sentences, it's not putting people away and taking away their lives and the lives of everyone around them when we do this. And that's what we need to focus on.
Andy, real quick, because I need to take a short break here, but just responding to what Catherine had to say about your friend, anything you want to say?
Say that, so it was a mandatory minimum. I think it was a technicality. It was a really unfortunate situation. But what I'll say to Catherine is that, first of all, I think the prisons are overcrowded.
Yeah, and quickly,
your
please.
Assumption,
if you could.
Okay, your assumption that the mandatory minimums have a plus factor in there and there is violence behind that is a bit dangerous, because when you're looking at who's nonviolent, you need to look at what they got convicted on, not what might have happened that didn't show up on the record.
All right. Thanks, Andy. Sorry to cut you off there. You're listening to Forum, and we're talking with Alex Busansky, president of Impact Justice, and Catherine Hahn, former federal prosecutor with the Department of Justice in San Francisco. This is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED, go to kqed.org. I'm Scott Schaefer. Let's continue on, if you don't mind, about
California. Can you just mention,
yeah,
just
Alex,
mention at some
yeah.
point that I was a former prosecutor?
You're a former prosecutor
both
as well.
State and federal.
Okay. All right. Good. Stated. There we go. It's okay. On the record. We've got some comments from listeners online. Reynolds writes, 20 years of three strikes incarceration resulted in increasingly lower rates of crime. Year after year, suddenly Props 47 and 57 get enacted. Then property crime and robbery rates skyrocket. Don't believe these soft-on-crime propagandists. And then a listener tweets, Hahn's argument that mandatory sentences are a tool of discretion is completely absurd. Prosecute the violent crimes directly. Let me just ask, I realize we may digress here a little bit. It is fairly soon still after the enactment of Props 47 and 57, but we are seeing property crimes, robberies, those kinds of things going up. How concerned, Alex, are you that perhaps the state has gone too far?
I think it is too early to tell. I think we're seeing different results across the state. I think one of the other issues that we are seeing is how are our investments paying off on alternatives, on treatment, on employment opportunities, on reentry programs and reentry services. So, but it's not mandatory minimums. It's not longer sentences. That isn't the response.
And Catherine Hahn, how does you're based here in
right.
the Bay Area, and so it's probably the most liberal part of the state. How do federal prosecutors view this sort of version of criminal justice reform that California has been undergoing for the last 6-7 years?
Well, I think a lot of people would be surprised to learn that people involved in law enforcement in our community here actually support prison reform. Relieving stress in the prison population is something that really everyone can get behind, but we have to be smart about how we're doing it. And that's what I think we're not being smart about how we're doing
Which part isn't smart?
Prop 57, for example, again, this here again is the problem with the narrative that just doesn't reflect reality. Look, all of us would be happy to trade a low-level drug dealer sitting in prison for a serial rapist. But I just want to rattle off some of the crimes that Prop 57 deems nonviolent that actually sound pretty darn violent to me. Rape, human trafficking involving sex with minors, drive-by shooting, assault with a deadly weapon, hostage taking, attempting to explode a bomb at a hospital or school, domestic violence involving trauma, supplying a firearm to a gang member, hate crimes.
All right. We get the idea.
Yeah. So those aren't nonviolent.
Alex, would you want to refute that at all?
Prop 57, there's this idea about what is violent and what is nonviolent. And I think it drives much of the debate that we have in this country and in this state now.
Would you agree that the crimes that she just mentioned involve violence?
I think, yes, many of them involve violence. Are they violent offenses? How do we treat those? What do we do? What is the response? I don't think, again, that Prop 57 is saying those crimes – Prop 57 is not saying those crimes cannot be prosecuted. Those crimes do not demand and require accountability of the people who perpetuate them. The question is, what do you do with those people and how do you treat the conduct?
And also, I mean, Catherine, it's also about parole, right? It's about whether those people have reformed. You know, we call it now the Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation.
Right.
And so they're looking at the rehabilitation. Is that not a fair thing to do?
Well, it's absolutely a fair thing. And we're under the sentencing factors. One of the things that you look to is rehabilitation and deterrence of future crimes, right? And all of us hope that people coming out of prison go on to lead a different course of life. Obviously, that's very hard for a lot of individuals coming out of that system to do.
And a lot of the people that committed some of the crimes that you mentioned may have been addicted to drugs, perhaps, and had that easy access to guns, which is not to excuse it, of course.
Absolutely, because it doesn't excuse it for the victims, right?
Right.
Rape, human trafficking involving sex with children. These have real victims. And I do want to make the point, I'm not for mandatory minimums for mandatory minimum's sake. I agree with a lot of what Alex has said to a point. I think we need to be smart about where we're using those tools.
I'm sorry. Didn't mean to interrupt.
Oh, I was just going to say they're important tools for prosecutors to have in their arsenal. And it is our absolute responsibility as a prosecutor. And I've taken an oath to do that, to make sure that we're using them only in the right cases.
We're really short on time. But just real quickly, because a lot of people are concerned about how the DOJ may now look at marijuana laws in California now. We're going toward legalizing recreational use for 21 and older. Should people involved in that industry be concerned about the federal government?
Well, there is. I mean, I think Attorney General Sessions has been pretty clear that that is still a federal offense. And again, I think there's a lot of tendency to blame prosecutors and law enforcement. But I want to highlight that it's Congress who passes the law. It's up to us to enforce the law. That's what we're supposed to do. That's our job.
Alex, last thought.
I think everybody should be concerned. I think the one thing we know about Attorney General Sessions is that everything is on the table until it's not on the table.
All right. Well, great conversation. And we could have gone on for another hour. And I'm sure we'll come back to it. Alex Busansky, president of Impact Justice, Catherine Hwan from the Department of Justice in San Francisco. Thank you both very much.
Thank you, Scott.
Thank you.
Forum is produced by Irene Noguchi, Tina Lauerberg, Judy Campbell, Jeremy Siegel, and Susan Britton. And our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our engineer is Howard Gelman. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai. And we get online support from Amanda Font. Our interns are Devin Holt and Stephanie Roberts. Our managing editor is Ethan Lindsay. And our executive producer is Holly Kernan. I'm Scott Schaefer, in for Michael Krasny. Thanks for listening.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by Jan Schramm and Maria Minetti Schramm, founders of the Minetti Schramm Museum of Art at UC Davis, which preserves the legacy of renowned artists such as Wayne Thiebaud for future innovators by dedicating a third of its space to arts education.